attack, an airstrike on the central fire station in the southern city of Bin Jebel, claimed the lives of 10 members of the Lebanese Civil Defense. The station was serving 35 villages in South Lebanon. The Israeli military also announced plans to expand aggression, specifically along Lebanon's coastline. The Lebanese government reported that over 400,000 people have fled into Syria in less than 2 weeks. From Beirut, our correspondent Mariam Saleh joins us to tell us more about the ongoing developments there in Lebanon. Well, Mariam, what do you have for us?
Well, as you know, the strikes on southern suburbs of Beirut continued, and the sounds of explosions were so loud to the extent that people across the areas far away from Beirut, even reaching Mount Lebanon and the areas of Sidon and Shouf district, were also able to hear the sounds of explosions that targeted the southern suburbs of Beirut. We also have many reports coming out from the Lebanese Nuclear Association and the Chemical Associations, stressing that what they know from, based on the smell and the smoke and the type of weapons that are being used by the Israelis, they believe that what is being used is illegal weapons and illegal warheads, either depleted with uranium and other forms of phosphorus that is within the warheads that are used by the warplanes. And so this is another issue that will be brought to the spotlight, how the Israelis are using illegitimate weapons that are being given to them by the United States. And this is part, of course, of the for what people are calling another trial. They are trying new weapons, new forms of bombs to use them on Lebanon, especially in areas in southern suburbs of Beirut, which will make, even if the war ends, it will make it almost impossible for that area to be inhabited anytime soon. It would take various years, in addition to the fact that it needs to be rebuilt, rehabilitated. But also the chemicals and the type of weapons that are used would not allow any humans to come close to it. And of course, this is in addition to the various attacks on the villages and towns in South Lebanon. For example, the town of Bar Ashid, which was a witness of very heavy shelling, in addition to the town and the city of Sur and Tyre. We also heard conflicting reports about the Israelis basically sending threats about people staying all across the coast of Lebanon, from the edges of Ras al Naqoura all the way to the areas of Beirut as well, threatening that they will also be targeting the coastline in all these areas, which would mean that the Israelis will be enforcing a siege from the sea, in addition to what they have enforced upon the Beirut International Airport. We do have some planes still functioning. Of course, the airport still functions, but in a manner which is very limited, and only evacuation planes and relief effort planes are arriving in the international airport. Of course, the Israelis have said that they transformed a lot of the settlements. First, it was only Miskatan, Yad Shmona, very limited areas that they transformed into military zones, closed military zones, based on their statements officially. And now we have additional settlements transformed into military zones, closed military zones, and so there, this allows the Israelis, of course, not to allow any media from their side to be able to see whether there are casualties and what exactly is happening on that side. And it, but it also is important for Hezbollah, because we noticed that after the Israelis declared this, Hezbollah struck all of these towns, specifically the areas of the Malkiyi, for example, and Admit. These were all targeted by Shlomi as well. They were all targeted by Hezbollah. They also said that they transformed out of Al-Aramisha into a closed military zone. Also adding the forces, the number of forces and the elite forces that are in that area. We also heard yesterday a very significant a statement from a Hezbollah commander who said that based on Hezbollah's fighters monitoring of the border, they noticed how the Israeli forces, because they were incapable of moving into Lebanese territory from the areas where they met clear resistance, they are attempting now to move in areas behind United Nations interim force bases. And that is an issue which shows that the Israelis are using the United Nations peacekeepers as human shields. And Hezbollah commanders stress that the fighters were given orders not to shoot at that force specifically in order not to put the United Nations peacekeepers in harm's way. But unfortunately, if that does, of course, continue, that means the Israelis have, in addition to the fact that they continue to target civilians and have no concern for human lives, civilian human lives, and therefore also the United Nations peacekeepers will also be under the Israeli threat of being targeted by the Israelis. You've had also UNIFIL forces killed before in Qana in 1996. When the massacre was conducted, there were also several UNIFIL officers that were also killed in that strike as well. Of course, the Hezbollah operations continue. We know that there were several attacks. Today alone, there were thousands of rockets towards Yarmouk, as well as the areas of the launching sites in Dalton. And Dishon as well was targeted by Hezbollah. We also had another attack surrounding the Al Marsh post as well as the Hanita settlement. And Hezbollah targeted a group of soldiers in Shlomi, as I mentioned earlier. So that impact, that the stance of the resistance on the border seems to continue, of course, despite all these strikes and all attempts to weaken the resistance.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. From Beirut, Mariam Saleh. Thank you. Political commentator Paul Labrigidi says most countries of the world are silent regarding the Israeli aggressions against Gaza and against Lebanon because they're just afraid of the U.S. consequent reaction against them.
The rest of the world has been timid. They're afraid of what the United States will do to them. Maybe to hurt their trade. I don't know. But they are reducing trade with Israel, for example, and some are refusing to interact with Israel and to send Israeli to break diplomatic relations. And regardless of the assassinations, the effectiveness of the resistance is not less than what it has been in the past. It's more. Whereas the effectiveness of Israel is, militarily speaking, useless. They strike civilians. The civilians are not fighting. That's the definition of a civilian.
Iran's foreign minister has warned Israel not to test Tehran's will, saying any future attack by the regime on the country will be met with a harsher response. Abbas Araghchi made the remarks in the opening of a conference in Tehran dubbed Al-Aqsa Flood, the beginning of Nasrallah. Araghchi noted that Iran is continuously monitoring Israeli actions and will neither hurry nor delay in responding to them. He reaffirmed that Iran will continue to stand by the region's axis of resistance to counter Israeli crimes. The top diplomat also reminded that last year's Al-Aqsa Flood operation dealt a heavy and irreparable blow to the Zionist regime. Tuesday's conference was held on the first anniversary of the operation with the presence of several foreign ambassadors and top Iranian officials. The breaking news, the Iranian foreign minister has made a statement. Mr. Araghchi, we are ready for all scenarios. Our armed forces are at the highest level of alert in reference to the Israeli regime in case it wants to venture out and risk getting retaliation back from the Islamic Republic. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip continue to endure more attacks as the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war in the blockaded territory enters its second year. Two strikes hit homes in the Baraj refugee camp in central Gaza. The attacks killed over 20 Palestinians, including five children and two women, with many others injured. In a separate incident, three Palestinians were killed and several others injured when tents for the displaced Palestinians in the same camp were struck. On Monday evening, at least eight Palestinians were killed after the regime shelled a group of civilians in the Jabalia refugee camp north of Gaza. In Gaza City and Beit Lahia, five Palestinians were killed in strikes, with several others injured. The death toll from the ongoing conflict has now risen to over 41,900, with more than 97,000 others wounded. The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, Philippe Lazzarini, has described the situation in Gaza as sheer barbarism, emphasizing the need for an end to the violence. Lazzarini said the Gaza Strip has been transformed into a, quote, unrecognizable sea of rubble after 12 months of relentless airstrikes and warfare. He added the Gazans have been going through forced displacement, disease, hunger, and death for the past year. He also highlighted the suffering of the children in Gaza and the traumatic lifelong effects of war on them. Lazzarini expressed concern over the current situation in schools of the Gaza Strip, saying that the children are sifting through rubble instead of being in classrooms. The U.S. has supplied Israel with around $18 billion in military aid since the genocide in Gaza began October of last year. That's according to a report by the American Brown University's Costs of War Project. The report says the expenditure includes $4 billion towards replenishing Israel's Iron Dome and David's Sling missile defense systems, as well as cash for guns and jet fuel. It states that an additional $5 billion in funding was supplied to U.S. military operations in West Asia during that time frame. The figure includes the costs associated with the U.S. military's attacks on Yemen. Washington has also provided Israel with diplomatic support, preventing the U.N. from obliging the regime to end the genocide. In Yemen, massive protests have taken place to mark the first anniversary of the Al-Aqsa flood operation, following a call by the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. Demonstrators across several cities voiced solidarity with the people in the Gaza Strip and Lebanon. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more from Sana'a.
The streets of Sana'a and more than a dozen other cities in Yemen were flooded with demonstrators, all responding to a call by Hamas resistance movement to mark the first anniversary of the Al-Aqsa flood. The demonstrators gathered under the banner "Float Towards Liberation," holding up pictures of martyred resistance leaders. Protesters expressed support for the Islamic resistance in Palestine and Lebanon, as well as operations by Yemeni armed forces targeting Israeli and American assets.
Today is the 7th of October, which means a year of battle with the Israeli regime. The Yemeni people have gone through 10 years of aggression against them and have not submitted or changed their choice in confronting the aggression. That means 1 year of American aggression against us cannot change our firm support for the Al-Aqsa flood. There will never be fear or retreat from Yemeni military operations.
Since the beginning of the Israeli brutal war on Gaza, Yemeni armed forces have launched over 1,000 missiles and drones at Israeli targets, including naval ships and drones. Israeli occupied territories were also targeted with the drones and hypersonic missiles. In return, Yemen has been subjected to hundreds of air raids by American, British, and Israeli forces, resulting in significant casualties, 82 people killed and 340 injured.
Today's demonstrations reveal that the Yemeni people support the resistance operations, whether it is the Palestinian operation that hit Beersheba or the Hezbollah operation that targeted Haifa. This protest means our position is firm and that we follow the path of our martyred leaders who gave their lives for the redemption of Gaza. They were led by Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, who embodied the meaning of sacrifice for the entire nation and for all free people in the world.
For the people on these streets, armed resistance is the only path to liberation. Despite the aggression on their own soil, Yemeni demonstrators remain unwavering in their support for Palestine and Lebanon, calling for an end to Israeli military operations and the liberation of all occupied territories.
Here in Sana'a, demonstrations are more than just a show of support. They are a reflection of Yemen's ongoing commitment to the Palestinian cause and the country's active role as part of the resistance front. From the streets to the battlefield, Yemenis continue to push for what they see as the only solution in hand, that is, armed struggle against Israel. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Islamic resistance in Iraq says it has carried out a successful drone attack on a military target in the occupied Palestinian territories. In a statement, the Umbrella Group for Iraq's anti-terror factions has said it struck a military target within the occupied lands using multiple explosive-laden unmanned aerial aircrafts. The Iraqi resistance has intensified its attacks on the Israeli military targets all over the occupied territories, from the Jordan Valley to the port of Haifa and beyond. It said the operation was carried out in solidarity with Palestinian and Lebanese people, as well as in retaliation for the massacres committed by the Israeli regime against civilians, including women, children, and the elderly. The group emphasized that it will continue to target and destroy important installations across the Israeli-occupied lands. A year into the Israeli genocidal war in Gaza, Americans have once again taken to the streets in New York to denounce the crimes committed against the Palestinians and Lebanese people.
We're voting for genocide!
Thousands of pro-Palestinian demonstrators marched through Manhattan to protest against the Israeli wars in the Gaza Strip and Lebanon. Police clashed with peaceful protesters and detained six of them outside of the New York Public Library at Times Square. Earlier, hundreds of protesters staged a walkout at Columbia University, and hundreds more gathered for a vigil at Central Park, with attendees including New York's mayor and governor. Meanwhile, pro-Palestine rallies were also held in some Latin American countries, with Argentinians demanding an arrest warrant for Israeli officials. And that does it for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Conversation. Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we talk to one of Ireland's finest comedians, a man that has recently taken Twitter by storm, now also an author. His recent book details the horrific consequences of addiction and the redemptive process of recovery. Never shying away from politics, he's been a strong advocate for Irish unification and Palestinian self-determination. Tadhg Hickey, welcome to the show.
Thanks a million, Sean. Delighted to be here.
Delighted to have you. So tell me, Tadhg, I've recently read your book and I was bemused by some of it, so the honesty in the reading in the book. And actually, it was an amazing book, and it's great to see someone just put it out there like you did, particularly you're a comedian, you know, and you're not very, very funny, but also very, very profound. I really enjoyed
it. Jesus, thanks a million, man. Thank you.
And the stuff, I mean, your childhood growing up, do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, like, I'd say it was a happy childhood, you know, so, and this is the funny thing about drinking, because alcoholism is a mental illness, and that's kind of the premise of the book, I suppose. I feel like in Ireland, people think of drinking and drinkers and alcoholics as a kind of an aberration, you know, that they've done something wrong morally, but the fact is that they're sick, and I was sick, but I wasn't always sick. And I suppose that's the point of the childhood. There was moments where I felt, you know, and when I say sick, I mean you need something to treat the illness, and the illness really is kind of, for me anyway, anxiety. Uncomfortableness, I think, is I might have called it, but I wouldn't have put the term anxiety on it, but that anxiety would have come and it would have gone. You know, it wasn't something that was there all the time. It would kind of spike, and it would spike in bizarre settings. Like, I remember being a kid and playing soccer with my buddies and just this kind of sense of gloom coming over myself and feeling uncomfortable in myself. And, like, it was kind of working class 80s Cork. Like, I wasn't about to go home and, you know, call a family meeting about it. We didn't talk about those kind of things. And as I say, when I was struck with a bit of anxiety, I probably thought I was mad. There was a big fear, whether it was just me or it was my community, you didn't want to be mad, you know. Mad people were taken away by men in white coats and they were brought to hospital. Sometimes if your drinking got totally out of hand, you'd kind of wander in over the line into madness, like, and so-and-so, he's gone away to some place and he's kind of locked up. That's what you didn't want. And that would have been a fear of mine from a very early age, because this anxiety, I wouldn't have called it that at the time. The feeling comes up, you're kind of going, am I mad? But then it would go away again, and I'd enjoy doing the things I did, like playing football and hanging out with my mates and stuff. And as I say, I was a happy kid. I was obsessed with my dad. I used to kind of follow my dad around. He was a good bit older. I was a real afterthought in the family. I was quite young. But as I detail in the book, he was an ordinary man, but he was extraordinary to me. Like, he just seemed like he had life all figured out. Whereas I felt like I was kind of caught up in myself. I was worried how I was coming across. Did people like me? How do I get people to like me? he just seemed to be breezing through life, not worrying about any of these things. You know, he just seemed to have it figured out.
And you also noted in the book that your saviour was through acting and writing. You want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so the uncomfortableness that I had, to go back to that again, that could, you could get rid of that loads of different ways. When I was younger playing sport, I played soccer, reasonable level in Cork. I wasn't a bad soccer player, and that would often take it away. But getting involved in performing or acting a bit, normally the type of acting I try to do involved comedy, and I suppose that was the origins of the comedy thing. Putting on voices, making funny noises, taking the piss out of people in my family, and doing impressions of them, all that kind of stuff. And when I was performing, and mostly in school and with friends and stuff, people would laugh, and that was another addiction straight away. Like, but it definitely got rid of that feeling of uncomfortableness, and it gave me a sense of that this is kind of the thing that I'm supposed to be at. And when I was doing the thing that I was supposed to be doing, I felt, and that I felt like I was enjoying it, again, just that feeling of, like, there's something up with me, I feel uncomfortable and I can't put my finger on it, just started to dissipate.
So what was the spark then that led to a career in comedy?
I think one of the first moments that I thought to myself, I would like to do comedy, was actually when I was a kid, and my sister and myself were very close, and she was she had a real influential role on my taste in everything. And she also had a really refined kind of sense of humour and kind of, you know, Rick Mail and The Young Ones and all that type of kind of anarchic British comedy, which I loved. So I used to try and make her laugh. And I thought if she laughed at something that I had said, that was a good bar, you know, that I'd made my sister laugh because she was funny. And then it became a kind of a thing of like, oh, how much can I get her to laugh? And like, oh, she didn't like this thing. And it's like my first audience, I suppose. I was also trying to make my mother laugh and whatnot. And then I remember going to, so by secondary school, I think, you know, the feeling of starting secondary school is, I was a fat kid as well, right? I hope I can say fat. I know it's probably not the nice thing to say these days, but I am saying it about myself. And I got to school, you're fat, my hair was kind of weird, and you're just self-conscious, like, you're kind of going, how am I going to fit in here? My brothers, as I say, were tougher men, and they probably would have went straight into the kind of, like, I'll kick your head in type of thing. And I knew I didn't really have that in me, but I knew I had a sharp tongue, and I knew it could make people laugh, and I also knew I could make people a bit scared, because if they mocked you and you mocked them back and you made other people laugh more, I was aware that that was a real strong currency. So I just fell into kind of making people laugh, and no one really bullied me, and I kind of went to the top of the kind of social structure in school because I was able to look after myself with my tongue as opposed to my fists, you know. So that was the first inkling that I was kind of, that I was good at it. But then you go on this whole journey of, you know, am I going to be so cocky as to demand that people sit in a room and listen to me because I'm so funny? Like, that for me, that's an incredibly, it's an audacious expression of self-confidence and self-belief. What I initially did, I did music, and I love music as well. I mean, that was a huge, huge passion of mine. I was in a band, and I would try and make some of the lyrics funny. And I was kind of playing the role of a comedian within a band. So I was hiding in a band as a comedian, I think. We were called Exit Pursued by a Bear.
What did you call it?
Exit Pursued by a Bear. So it's a pretentious quote from Winter's Tale. And the whole band was very pretentious. And I was the main reason for that. But that was my way of kind of doing rock comedy or rock kind of theatrics, I suppose. And then later on, when that folded, I was kind of doing bits and pieces of acting, and then an opportunity arose to start a comedy troupe. So again, it was not me on my own, it's me with two other people. So that was the kind of journey, I suppose, into comedy.
There's a film, isn't there? It's a bit like The Office, because I know you were a fan of The Office.
Yeah.
And it's about a rock group of that kind. And I know Ricky Gervais was actually influenced, isn't it? What was the name of that film?
Oh my God, what's it called? Lads.
Spinal Tap.
Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
I actually feel, this is a weird thing to say, but I feel like I've got a bit in common with Ricky Gervais. Like, he was, like, you know, a big influence of mine. He was in a band. He studied philosophy in college, and he was, like, kind of, you know, doing his own thing, and then kind of fell into this big, massive comedy opportunity. So I always felt I'd get to a certain age, probably 40, and then these massive comedy opportunities would happen for me. Hasn't happened yet, John. Not down south, anyway. I'd probably get more work, like, in the Middle East. But anyway, that's another story.
Well, now, speaking about the Middle East and more closer to home, politics closer to home, a lot of your comedy revolves around politics. And I read somewhere that you were influenced, maybe slightly, in your politics by the Late Late Show one night. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. I think it was possibly 1994, I think it was. So I was a kid. At that stage, it would have been probably 10 or 11. And just I was watching it live, I suppose, like most of Ireland watched Late Late Show at the time. And forgive me, I don't have all the members of the panel, but it was Jerry Adams was giving an interview, and it was a thing. We were watching it because Jerry Adams was going to be on. And it was a fairly apolitical house that I grew up in. You know, people probably were sympathetic to the Republican struggle, but not in any demonstrative way, really. And certainly from the media that we consumed, we kind of were to believe that Jerry Adams almost personified all the problems with the North, that almost like, you know, every aspect of the conflict was on his shoulders and that he bore personal responsibility for everything that had happened. I think it was the same night that Gay Byrne refused to shake his hand, and he basically sat down, and I didn't know that much about him before then, and I didn't know that much about the North either. And I think that's the key point, that, you know, when I watched that interview, I think Austin Curry was part of the panel, there was basically a lineup of people trying to take pops at him and traduce him in a variety of ways and to pin, as I say, the whole conflict on his shoulders. And I just witnessed somebody really calmly, without any emotion whatsoever, refute every accusation that was coming to him, but more importantly, contextualised the conflict for the first time. I'd never heard that before. I hadn't heard anything about loyalist paramilitaries before. I just thought there was one, and I wasn't quite sure who they were fighting as a kid, but I just knew the IRA were fighting Britain, and that the impression I got from the mainstream media down south was that, you know, Ireland had won its independence, a few counties didn't make the grade, unfortunately, and they were kicking up all this storm and violence and murder because they were prone to murderousness. And we wish that they would just stop it because they're really embarrassing us now on a kind of an international level. Now, I'm being a little bit playful when I say that, but that is roughly the sense of the North I had as a kid. So I wouldn't even say that I became like an Irish Republican watching that interview from Jerry Adams. I just became somebody that was really interested in the North. And that was the main thing for me. And because nobody had ever contextualised the conflict before, and more importantly, nobody had ever stated the important role that the South had played or not played, as whichever way you'd look at it, in creating the causes and conditions. And nobody had ever kind of detailed that before. For me, up until that moment, it was a kind of a separate thing. It was happening in a different place. It was unconnected to us. And as I say, we wished that they would just stop it. So definitely my head blew off my shoulders. I was like, okay, there's more to this than the mainstream media in the South is portraying. There's much more to this story than RTE and The Independent and The Irish Times are telling us. Because even, I mean, as a young kid, I was just interested in the news and, you know, I'd read bits and pieces of the newspaper and stuff. But so, yeah, that there was another alternative version of this history out there was new to me.
And did that galvanise you to explore things further, just politically? I mean, did you read up more on what was happening in the North? Or?
Yeah, I mean, within a few years, I suppose, I would have been a Sinn Féin supporter, I suppose, in school. And that would have been unusual, I think, in the South in that period as well. I remember there was two lads in my in my class in secondary school, and we were both kind of interested in Sinn Féin. And we went to a Sinn Féin youth meeting. And one of the lads, Ken is his name, he had a copy of Unfublocked, and I was reading Unfublocked on my lunch break, and one of my teachers took me outside the door to ask me, was everything all right at home? and I think, you know, nothing that I've come across since encapsulates the complete misunderstanding of everything in the North that was going on down south at the time. And, you know, some people were doing it maliciously, you know, some people had agendas, but most people were just eating up the propaganda. And you see it today in the conflict that's going on right now in Gaza. Most people are just ordinary people going about their business. it's the people who are actually perpetrating and putting the propaganda out there. They have a responsibility. But your average person will become influenced by the propaganda that they consume. So I think most people down south just had this idea that there was just one perpetrator of violence in the north, and that Gerry Adams was a representative for them, and so he needed to be neutralised and censored, you know, and that's, I suppose, what was happening, literally.
You've mentioned Gaza there, and we'll get to that in a second. I just want to probe you more about your involvement with Irish reunification. And when I say involvement, you've been a strong advocate for reunification. Why is it important to you?
I think it's important to me because it connects directly to what I was saying earlier of growing up in a state that felt like it was completely disconnected from this other state. As soon as I started reading, I realised that that's not the case at all, and that there's a community of people in the north that don't feel disconnected. They feel the opposite. They feel like, you know, not that they feel Irish, they are Irish, and they think of themselves as part of the island of Ireland, and it would be their wish that that would be a 32-county republic. I think as you move towards breaking that sense of separation between the two, and you can do it physically. So, you know, I'm one of the few people I know in the south that goes to the north regularly, you know, and I'm not saying that in any kind of a flex. It's an embarrassing thing to say. The comedians on the scene, like Mario Rosenstock would be a good friend of mine. I think he's amazing. And he was telling me that I think he went to Belfast for the first time a couple of years ago, and that would be typical. The man's been touring for 20 years, and he was wondering would people kind of know his stuff, whatever. And like the gig was sold out. I think he either did Ulster Hall or somewhere massive anyway. And everyone knew his stuff. Everyone had been following his stuff. And it's just typical of that sense of that kind of like spiritual, emotional, practical disconnect. I have, be it in my work, in my social life, and, you know, making friends up here and stuff, that disconnect has never really been there for me. And if the disconnect isn't there, it makes no sense that they're two different states. Also, the history of Irish republicanism, I mean, if you're an Irish republican and you're an anti-imperialist, it would feel that it's the fitting thing for the destiny of the country would be to be reunited. And I would definitely make no apologies for that. It can sometimes be a slightly controversial thing to say or a slightly uncomfortable thing to say down south. And what I'm trying to do a little bit with my work is to get to the root of why anyone should be made to feel that that's uncomfortable. And I think, you know, something that we've spoken about a bit off camera, young people are amazing because young people are challenging that southern perspective all the time, that it's two separate states and two separate mentalities. So they're just some of the reasons why, I suppose, as an Irish Republican, shocker, I would want to see United Ireland.
You're still tuned into The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs around Ireland. I'm joined by our special guest, comedian and author, Tadhg Hickey. Moving on to events in Gaza that we've been all horrified by this last few months. You've been a very strong advocate for Palestinian self-determination. Has that been? And we spoke earlier, you said you'd met many new friends in the Middle East and stuff like that. Tell us a bit about that.
I think with Palestine, and it's a little bit like with United Ireland as well, it comes back to something we touched on at the start of, like, in my drinking, I was inauthentic. You have to be inauthentic to kind of survive. You have to lie. You have to cheat. You have to let people down in order to keep doing it. And when I got sober, one thing I was very clear about for myself was to actually protect myself, to stop myself from falling into possibility of drinking again and taking drugs again, which I know will ultimately lead, if I relapse, I've no doubt that I'll die, and I don't want to die. So it's very basic with me. I have to be authentic. So if I have personal views about the conflict, and if I have personal views about my perspective on wanting a United Ireland, needless to say, a United Ireland that would be inclusive of everyone, not a narrow nationalism. I have no interest in that. If I have those views, I need to reflect those views in my work in order to be authentic. That's the way I would look at it, you know, and I hope that doesn't sound too kind of, I don't know, lavish or pretentious or whatnot, but that's the way I do think. So for instance, if I would lose some work opportunities down south for being authentic in my views, that would be that's absolutely fine collateral damage. I need to be authentic. So in the case of Palestine, I have always felt that it's actually one of the most, bizarrely, it's one of the most easy conflicts to understand, which is in direct opposition to the key Israeli claim that it's too complex for you and I to ever understand. It's just a case, it's a land grab, it's settler colonialism. And I think if I'm going to be authentic about Ireland, I need to also be authentic about Palestine and not worry too much about the backlash that you will get. Also, I have friends that are doing comedy in the States and Canada and places like that. They have backlash, like they have serious, I mean, you know, they have serious repercussions to worry about. In Ireland, it's less so. So I feel like, you know, many Arab friends have sent me messages. I mean, if you saw my messages on Instagram, like you'd be, it's hard not to be crying at times because there's people saying, you know, it's refreshing to hear someone from the West just highlight what's going on here. Like, so it's basically like Ireland on a kind of a global level for me. It's like, you know, people hating you because they don't want to have the conversation, and then people loving you because they see it's unusual for a white face to be fronting something that's talking about the decades of oppression, murder, mayhem, second-class citizenship, you name it, apartheid that they're living under. So, again, if you're going to be authentic, you accept that you're going to get some people, you know, I had a Zionist witch saying that she was putting a curse on me and all that kind of stuff. But then I had loads of Muslim friends saying that they'd undone the curse. So that was a bit of crack, like, you know. But as regards work and stuff, I made a kind of a pact with myself a long time ago that I was going to be real to me anyway. I'm not saying it's the reality. It's my belief system. And if that means that I don't get work with the BBC or RT, then so be it.
I think you're being too kind to yourself when you say, you know, you don't get it hard here as an artist when you stray off the conventions. I mean, like, we as a country steeped in censorship, I think still if you stray off those conventions that you do get it hard. And you see that particularly from establishment journalists, establishment politicians. And I think you've been the receiving end of that also.
Yeah, I suppose with journalists, they'll have jobs. Like, I don't, like, because I'm working for myself, I'm lucky. You know what I mean? Like, they'll attempt to, you know, so there's people online who've tried to get my gigs cancelled and whatnot.
Welcome to the club.
Huh?
Welcome to the club.
Yeah. I suppose that's, you know, to be honest with you, that can be tough at times because, you know, when that campaign was going online by this, I say campaign as being kind to the guy, like, cause it seemed to just be one guy. But, like, I also have a new baby, you know, and I have a partner and I have kids, like, I've got two kids. So, like, it's easy for me to be like, you know, it's like the song, you know, my love ain't got no money, but he's got a strong beliefs. It's grand for me to say that, but I need to be able to provide for my family as well. So it can be scary at times to think that, oh, OK, what happens here if I actually get completely cancelled? But I don't know, maybe I'm just a bit of a dreamer that way, but I just kind of think if you just plough on. And also, I feel like with the stuff I'm doing, I'm not being nasty either, really. You know what I mean? I'm not kind of like, I'm not doing a Dave Chappelle on it. Don't get me wrong, Dave Chappelle is a comedy god to people like me. You know, his early stuff is, the Chappelle Show is some of the best satire I've ever seen in my life. And that's what makes it so sad that he went from punching up so elegantly to now just lazily punching down. But I feel myself, and I'm always checking in with people that I respect to see, am I doing the right job with it? You know, before I write a sketch about Palestine, for instance, I've got about two or three Palestinian friends that I run it by just to make sure that the detail is there and stuff, because I don't want to become lazy or assume that that they want this white lad from Cork to speak for them. Like, you know, even at the start of when October 7th happened and then the absolutely insane response that we've seen since, some people said, oh, you should do a sketch on this or you should do a sketch on that. I asked Palestinians because I was like, this mightn't be the moment for comedy. You know, I don't want to come in on something like, it's hard to even think of what, and you'll be able to tell me better, what the Irish parallel for this is. You know, what Palestinians are going through right now. I mean, it feels like it's Nakba 0.1 or whatever, like, you know. So was comedy even an appropriate thing to do? And time again, they'd come back. And that's, I think, why Irish and Palestinians get on so well. They've got this jet black sense of humour. My Palestinian friends in Cork were like, man, we need you, like, get in there. Like, and also, a good buddy of mine in Cork was kind of saying, you'll never have an opportunity like this again because the other side is making such a show of itself with its so-called propaganda that you've got to get in there, like, or it's a missed opportunity if you don't, you know. So, yeah.
So tell us, what's happening this year? What are we going to see next from Tadhg Hickey?
Well, I've been lucky enough to build up a nice little following from the Arab world. Like on Instagram, I have, just if you're interested, I have much more followers in Turkey and Jordan than I would in Ireland. Really? Way more, like, yeah. Doesn't surprise me at all, by the way. So I'd like, I mean, in an ideal world, if I was going to do a tour again, I'd love to tour over there. I'd love to tour in places where it's news to me that someone from the West having a kind of an anti-imperialist perspective and somebody shining a light on the hypocrisy and atrocities of the American Empire, that would be a refreshing thing to see from their perspective. But it is. So I'd like to eventually go over there and tour there. And also, for a while now, I've been trying to turn a sketch I did a couple of years ago that caused a lot of controversy. You may have seen it, about a loyalist and a house share in Cork with the, you know, England, Scotland, Ireland and all that. I've been trying to turn that with another writer in Ireland, Michael West is his name, brilliant writer, playwright, into a full kind of TV show stroke film kind of effort. So, but it would go above, I mean, they're just standing for the actual, you know, that there's no depth to any of those characters. Like, it's just, you know, Scotland is just a crazy wig and a kind of a Scotland jersey. But I've built them up, we've built them up into full dimensional characters. I hope it could be a TV show. And I'm talking to people of significance who are interested in it, shall we say. So I would love to see some sort of Brexit, but it's a house share in Cork, develop into a TV show or a film.
Tadhg, looking forward to that. And it's always good to see you in Belfast. I'd say it'd be safe to consider your second home now.
Oh, man. Well, definitely West Belfast anyway.
Well, listen, thank you for coming. Always good to see you.
Pleasure, brother.
Okay. And that does it for another week. We'd love for you to join the conversation by sharing the link to today's programme to help us grow our audience across all our social media platforms. I'd like to thank our special guest, Tadhg Hickey. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. And may great peace and blessing be upon Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam and his household. Assalamu alaikum. My dear audience, brothers and sisters, and welcome back to the series of talks for humanity. I'm Hamza Azizi from IRIB English Radio. I'm sure you remember we've been talking about the Quranic teachings about the individual and personal attributes of human beings, regardless of his communications with other human beings or with whoever is around him. We are talking about the individual attributes of the ideal human being in Quranic point of view. Previously, we talked about several aspects, or let's say several attributes and ideal behaviors. We talked about at-tafakkur, thinking. We talked about gaining knowledge. We talked about working, trying, and we talked about the purity and impurity. And now, in this episode, we are going to start a series of talks about patience. Patience is one of the individual characteristics that human beings should have, and it's a kind of ideal merit of the human beings based on Quranic teachings. The issue of patience is a very quite comprehensive topic, and if we want to include and cover all the aspects of the patience mentioned in the Holy Book, that might take tens of episodes. We try our best to briefly touch this topic and try to open a new window and an eye-opening discussion about this issue. Let's begin with this point, that the great figures, great Quranic figures, who have been introduced to us in this holy book, all of them were of the people who partake of patience. They were so patient examples. In the holy book, we have the story of Ayyub. Prophet Ayyub was known as a patient person. Let's start our talks with the story of Prophet Ayyub after a short break.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, my dear audience, brothers and sisters, to the series of Talks for Humanity. I'm Hamza Azizi, and this is IRIB English Radio. We are talking about the Quranic individual characteristics, one of which is the patience. We said that the Quranic great figures, all of them, they possessed this quality in their personality. And one of the most known of them was Prophet Ayyub. Even in some languages, his patience turned to be a kind of symbol and a kind of proverb. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about his story very briefly in a specific passage, in which he says that رَبِّ إِنِّي مَسَّنِيَ الضُّرْ. It's exactly in the middle, or almost at the end of his story. But based on the history and historical accounts and our narrations, Prophet Ayyub had a very interesting and at the same time strange story. throughout a specific period of time, he lost his children, then he got disease, then poverty, and because of his contagious illness, or even it might not be, maybe wasn't kind of contagious illness, but the people of his town, they kicked him and his wife out of the city because they spread a kind of rumor that Prophet Ayyub, along with his wife, they have a kind of contagious illness, so they didn't let them stay anymore in the city, so they used to live out of the city at the suburb, and then they were alone, poor, and during some specific days, they lacked food, and just imagine a kind of family that lost most of his members, and then they got disease, and then they lost money, and then they lost food, and then they lost the people, the city, the normal life and ordinary life that everyone deserves to have, such simple life. So at that point, according to our narrations, Shaytan tried a lot to convince Prophet Ayyub to make some, at least a single piece of complaint against Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But as a matter of fact, Prophet Ayyub rejected this temptation of devil, and he only asked Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that I'm in trouble. Rabbi inni massani al-dhur. And then happened what happened, that inshallah in the next episode we will continue this strange and interesting story of Prophet Ayyub, and to see what level of patience he partaked of. Thank you very much. Have a good time. Walhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa alihi. 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 Salli ala Muhammad wa alihi.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Hezbollah launches a barrage of missiles against Israeli bases and settlements as the deputy chief of the resistance movement vows to continue anti-regime operations. Iran's foreign minister once again warns of a harsher response if the Israeli regime carries out any future attack on the Islamic Republic. And more civilians are killed in the Gaza Strip as the Israeli regime presses ahead with its genocidal campaign in the blockaded Palestinian territory. Welcome. You've tuned to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, it's more than 2 weeks since Israel intensified its aggression against Lebanon. The regime's warplanes continue to pound residential areas relentlessly across the Arab country. Israeli military has carried out several new airstrikes on Beirut, particularly along the country's southern coast, leaving unknown number of casualties since pre-dawn on Tuesday. Now, the strikes indiscriminately target residential areas in villages, towns, and cities. Hezbollah's infrastructures are also on the target of the regime as part of its agenda to weaken the resistant group's defensive capabilities. The ongoing aggression has prompted mass evacuations, with more than 400,000 people already fleeing to Syria.